court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Welcome to Court Appointed, two dudes' perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, unless I'm mistaken, we were once again on the cutting edge of the news.
Yeah, apparently we had our robot episode go out, and about 3 days later, there's an article that, well, somebody posted it on our Facebook site about an AI robot that was granted citizenship in Saudi Arabia.
I don't even know how that works, but okay.
I don't either. We told you it was coming, and it was coming faster than we thought. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know how you look at it, we were recording our episode on time for last week, so this came out the day after we recorded. So we're kind of a week late in reporting on this, so we hope you didn't miss this robot walking by.
We are prognosticators and purveyors of fine, cutting-edge information.
There you go, right on the leading edge of the robot overlord uprising.
That's right.
And a robot named Sophia is going to lead them, evidently. So she's can be a citizen, but I don't know if she can drive.
She's a... What is it? Oh, Typhoid Sophia, the first one? Like that, Typhoid Mary?
Is that it?
The first one who leads the charge or whatever?
I guess.
I don't know where I was going with that.
Whatever the name, what was it, Caesar in Planet of the Apes? The first monkey that started the uprising there when the monkeys took over planet Earth?
Damn you, dirty apes. Well, continuing with our technology, we thought we would talk about... some lawsuits that shaped the internet. And Tommy came across an article that was written by Matt Stroud about these six cases that have essentially made the internet the place it is today.
Yeah, if you ever wondered why some things are okay and why things are done the way they are, there's these six lawsuits evidently are the ones that are cited for shaping it up and explaining why we do what we do with the internet and the wonderful tool that it is in today's society.
It's a tool?
Yeah, it's a tool.
Well, I use it quite a bit, so I guess we could say it's a bit more tool-like than a hammer.
Well, yeah, it's a sophisticated tool.
It's a sophisticated hammer?
I guess you could say that. It's like a spaceship hammer.
A spaceship hammer? Yeah. A hammer that answers all your questions.
Well, it gets out information a lot quicker than Tool gets out a new album. I'll tell you that, because we're still waiting on that new Tool album.
I'll tell you what, you know, I think if I didn't have a hammer as a tool, I could pick up a rock and probably make do with it. But if I didn't have the internet, I don't know what I would do.
If I didn't have a hammer, I wouldn't hit a rock. That's the wrong song, isn't it?
I think so.
Oh well, that was heading the other direction.
What's the first case?
All right, the first case, Reno versus American Civil Liberty Union. Now, I guess I should say Reno v. American Civil Liberty Union to keep in with what we do. We don't say versus, we say V, don't we?
V.
There was a question about that when we first started putting that up, but so I should stick with that.
And this was a 1997 case.
1997, and what this case was about was Congress passed... In 1996, passed the Communications Decency Act, and it was an attempt to regulate pornography and indecent material on the web, and more precisely, to keep kids away from some of the internet's less dignified elements. This act included a provision that threatened criminal prosecution against any party that knowingly sent anyone under 18 content that displayed any comment, request, suggestion, proposal, image, or other communication that, in context, depicts or describes in terms patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards, sexual or excretory activities or organs. Now, that definition in and of itself is pretty confusing and all-inclusive.
Yeah, no kidding. It's got you covered from head to tail.
Yeah, I'll say. And everything in between.
That's right.
So they tried to just basically say, look, you can't put anything on the internet the kids might see that we think is dirty.
Yep. Now, we kind of talked about pornography before in one of our previous episodes, and that we discussed essentially this case called Jacobulus v. Ohio, and it talked about like pornography, and there's that famous quote from Justice Potter Stewart in that
case. I'll know it when I see it.
That's right. And his quote from that case was, I shall not today attempt to further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within the shorthand description, hardcore pornography, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it, and the motion picture involved in this case is not that. So I just, any chance I get to say that quote, I really want to put that out there.
The way that starts out, it reminds me of, I think that I shall never see.
Yeah. But in this case, again, they're trying to limit what is essentially free speech by curtailing this kind of this expression. So that's something that is inherently looked upon very, very strictly by the courts.
Well, and in a way, what they were trying to do, so that with internet being new, they were trying to attach the same type of restrictions as they had on print media.
Yep, print media, or TVs.
Right, or you had like print media, you would have, they put the plastic wrap on magazines that were deemed to be, you know.
The good ones?
Yeah, the good ones. And they, a lot of times they had to keep them behind the counter so that people couldn't get them out in the store, things like that, to try to keep them out of the hands of those under 18 years old. Well, the question is, how do you keep images on the internet away from 18-year-olds? And I guess what it finally came down to is they said, you can't do it without restricting it to everybody.
Yeah.
And you can't make everybody else give that right up to try to keep it from children. Somewhere, I guess they said the parents or adults are going to have to be the ones responsible for keeping children away from it.
Yeah, and if you think about this, we also talked about this theory too, is that whenever you have these constitutional issues that are appealed to the Supreme Court, there's different tests that the court applies. One is the rational basis review, and that's if a law is rationally related to a legitimate government interest. And then we have strict scrutiny, which is the harder one to pass, and that's a narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. So maybe they didn't exactly apply this exact test there, but I think the theories are still kind of underlying with this case, in that it is, I mean, it's a compelling interest for the government to keep children from looking at what amounts to pornography.
Correct.
So we don't want that.
We don't want that.
Yeah. But the method they chose to do that with, by just censoring everybody, was not narrowly tailored. There's other ways they could have done that. There's parental filters that parents could put onto the computers or things like that. So basically, I think it would fail under any of those other tests too, that, you know, it's not narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. So, I mean, it is a compelling government interest, yes, but that was not narrowly tailored. That was just your basic no one gets it type of approach.
There's no way to narrow it down to just those that shouldn't be watching.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the court got that one right, and I think that is important, because free speech on the internet and the amount of content out there, I mean, even though there's stuff out there that certainly is not for everyone, you know, you might not want to see it, I might not want to see it, but it still has the right to be out there because somebody might, and it's kind of like free speech land.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note that Reno in that lawsuit was not the city in Nevada.
Not the biggest little city?
No, it was Janet Reno. Who was the attorney general at the time.
I actually thought it was the city of Reno.
No, it was.
I made a huge little mistake.
No, it was the attorney general. So, but that adds a whole new picture to that old saying about I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
It does.
I can't get that visual out of my mind.
So that's a pretty interesting case, and that was probably one of the first cases, and that's, you know, 97. That's right when the internet was really starting to kind of become very important and really get mainstream.
Yeah, that's when Mary was telling me, Tommy, we got to get one of those new home computers, and I was like, no, we don't need one of those things. We've got the World Book Encyclopedia. You don't need that.
You didn't have a computer?
I don't think so. Not then.
I had a computer like ever since I can pretty much remember, because Rick always had one and I got his hand-me-down. So I had his his Radio Shack computer, and then I had a VIC-20, and then I had a Commodore 64, and I had his old IBM 286, I think, and I had computers growing up.
So. Well, I know that we didn't get one until a few years after we moved back here, and we moved back here in 92.
Yeah.
So somewhere around there, maybe 95, 96, something like that.
I started with computers probably fourth or fifth grade.
But it wasn't hooked up to the internet. I mean, we had to get dial-up there eventually, but I can remember loading in like Encarta or something like that you loaded into your computer to get information from it and stuff. It wasn't hooked up to the web.
Well, before there was the internet, there was a bulletin board systems. And so basically you would call into a number and it was essentially somebody's computer that you were calling, and you could leave posts on there and things like that. And there was like directories of all these different bulletin boards around. And I actually had my own bulletin board that I was, we didn't have a separate phone line for it, but my parents let me operate it between like the hours of 11 o'clock at night until like 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning when I got up for school. So basically if somebody wanted to call my bulletin board, it was only operational during certain hours. And that really wasn't that uncommon because people didn't have separate phone lines and they had to keep their phone line for other stuff too. So it's kind of the baby internet, I guess you could speak.
And then Al Gore invented the internet and here we are today.
That's right. Thank goodness for Al Gore. So what's the next case?
Next case, Zarin v. America Online. Now, this case allowed website owners to host third-party content without having to worry about being prosecuted if someone published something illegal on that website. And what brought that about is about a week after the Oklahoma City bombings in April of 1995, Post appeared on an AOL message board, just like you were talking about, I guess, offering items for sale that were printed with multiple exclamation points witticisms such as "Visit Oklahoma, it's a blast," and "McVeigh for President, 1996.
Those are not very clever.
No.
But AOL is actually not like a bulletin board. AOL was actually, you would call into the AOL servers. So I guess it was maybe in theory kind of like a bulletin board, but it was like...
Well, it's a message board. That's pretty close to a bulletin board.
Okay, we'll just leave it at that. I can't debate that.
But anyway, so it said the Post directed users to contact Seattle resident Kenneth M. Zarin and listed the guy's home phone number, and the post was actually a bizarre prank. Zarin did not know anything about it. He had no connection to it. He doesn't know who did it, but the whole thing went viral after an Oklahoma City radio DJ encouraged his listeners to express their outrage at Zarin's for doing this.
Now, I got to admit, I think that is kind of funny.
That the DJ did that?
Well, no, that there was some random guy who had nothing to do with it that got, that got harassed.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it's not funny. It would be terrible. People would be giving you death threats and stuff.
It would be terrible, but that part's a little snarkier. I kind of appreciate that.
So anyway, he tried to sue this Zarin. He was getting all this grief because of all this, so he wanted to sue, the radio station for publicizing it, and also AOL for putting it out there. Well, of course, AOL didn't put it out there. Somebody published it through AOL. Right. So this was where they needed to establish the precedent. Did AOL have to go through and screen everything that was going up on its site to prove that it was correct?
Yeah. I mean, when I was reading this one, I kept thinking that it's like the thing for AOL was always like, "You've got mail." It's like, "You've been served." I don't know. I thought that was a AOL lawsuit joke. But that's as far as I got with it.
That's it?
Yeah.
That was all you got? You've been served. So now you got to show up.
Yep.
Be the easy way to do it, huh?
Yeah, but I think this is an important case because if you provide the forum for people to put these ideas out there, you certainly can't be responsible for making sure that all these ideas are suitable when they're not defamatory or don't cause any issues.
Well, the example they gave is imagine a site like YouTube. If you had to review every posting on YouTube to see that it met all the standards of veracity and decency and everything else.
Oh, I mean, I'll tell you, if I read 5 comments on YouTube, I have to wash my eyes out with bleach. YouTube is it's notorious for the worst comments on the internet.
Yeah, so
they're horrible.
That was what that established that you did not have to be responsible for third party.
A lot of places I'll go to the comment section to try to like get a bit more clarification about things, but YouTube is not one of those places. I choose not to do that. So, yeah, but that was a 1998 case. So, again, right about that same time, 97, 98, we're starting to get more into kind of, there was, I guess, almost a This is a burgeoning area of law at that point.
Exactly. It's all around that time because these things are all just coming to the forefront. It's like so many things. Everybody thinks, boy, this is going to be great. Oh, well, look at this problem. Oh, well, look at this problem. There are things you didn't think of.
You know what's interesting, too, is these cases, they stand for some pretty important things. And I mean, this affects our daily lives quite a bit because sure. Everyone uses the internet constantly. I mean, I'm addicted to the internet. I'll be the first one to admit it. I'm on there constantly looking things up, whether it's, you know, who is the captain of the HMS Bounty or I don't even know what other random thought might pop into my head. I don't know who that is, by the way.
Captain Ahab.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I'm constantly on there looking things up and doing that. I mean, these things probably affect our daily lives as much as any cases the Supreme Court's ever decided.
As much as our lives are ruled by the internet, yes.
Yeah. And what's funny, too, is that the time period that these went out, like, I still fancy myself a younger guy, you know?
I think you are, too.
But these cases, we didn't even talk about them in law school because they were too current. Like, we were talking more about, like, older stuff.
Right.
You know, I mean, so we didn't have an internet law class when I was in law school.
Well, think about the age of your professors.
Yeah.
So to them, they weren't probably much into the internet. So this was probably something that they didn't pay too close of attention to.
Well, even if they were into it, the area of law, the cases and the things that were coming out were, I mean, they were just coming out because mm-hmm. I graduated law school in 2002. So, you know, I was there in 99 and these cases had just been decided. They really hadn't. Disseminated out into the open yet. I mean, mm-hmm. with the internet being what it is, I'm sure they were able to be looked up, but it wasn't as widespread. You know, you didn't have Wikipedia with putting out these different cases or different things. Maybe even the Supreme Court opinions at that point, their website wasn't even up and running. So it wasn't, the information wasn't flowing out as readily as it is now.
Well, I don't think you had as much media as you have now as far as news and news articles and everything else. I mean, whether it's coming out over the internet or coming out on TV or coming out through apps and everything else. So there's a lot of this stuff that we're made much more aware of now than we used to be.
Absolutely. So we have another case that you're going to talk about, but I think before we get to that case, there's a motion or maybe several motions that need to be made today.
Why, we have a trifecta of motions to make today, Your Honor.
Well, you better get to making the motions then.
Well, we've got to ask for permission to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right, let's approach. Who we have on the docket today?
All right, first to approach the bench today is Cameron Hughes Wine.
I love Cameron Hughes Wine.
They are back with us again. We're always glad to have repeat business.
That's right.
And we got a chance to sample their wines.
Yep.
We had wine tasting party, and we can vouch for them being just absolutely exceptional.
And we got to speak with Cameron on the phone.
Talked to old Cam himself.
That's right. Got to talk to Cam.
Yeah, and he told us how they are able to make it so that with Cameron Hughes Wine, you can find fantastic quality wine at everyday prices. Like a bottle that would normally be $50, you can get it for $15.
And the thing about talking to Cam about his wine, you can tell that this guy is really into his wine. He knows what he's talking about. And he has a passion for trying to deliver wine at an affordable cost to everybody. Like that's this guy's mission. It's what he does.
I mean, we're talking quality wines at discount prices. And who doesn't want that? I mean, you want to drink wines like a millionaire, right? And you don't want to pay like a millionaire, though. So that's why the best wines come from Cameron Hughes Wine.
The thing about Cameron Hughes Wine is that you know you're getting the best deal always. Luxury wines at affordable prices.
Cameron has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Wine Enthusiast, The Wine Spectator, and he has serious industry cred. That's sort of like street cred, only in the industry.
What Cam does, he finds a needle in the haystack wine from top wineries around the world, blends them, and sells them direct to you under his label for 50% less than what you pay at retail.
And the clincher? Cam guarantees all his wines. If you are unhappy with any bottle you buy from him, he will make it right.
You just give him a call and say, Cam.
Cam, dude.
I need a different bottle of wine.
That bottle didn't pan out, dude. I need another one.
But you know what? It's not going to because it's going to pan out.
That's right. We've tried them all.
We have.
And they all are excellent.
I've tried them all and tried them all again just for good measure.
So find out why Cameron Hughes Wine is a preferred wine choice by informed and passionate wine lovers.
We want you to try these wines. So we talked to Cam, and he is going to give our listeners an incredible deal to try the wines.
I mean, we had to twist his arm a little bit, but now this is a deal. You get free shipping on three or more bottles and a free Sommelier grade corkscrew.
Sommelier.
I don't. It's a Sommelier corkscrew from Sommelier.
You can just say Som. Let's short it up there.
We do that again.
So this is a great deal, and you can try these already great discounted wines. And the thing about free shipping is that it's a huge savings. Wine is heavy and very expensive to ship, so Cam is really hooking you up by doing this.
This wine is fantastic, and this deal is fantastic. So do not miss out on this limited time offer. Go to chwine.com and use the code COURT right now.
That's chwine.com and enter the code COURT. Who do we have up next?
Next up is our old buddies at DollarShaveClub.com.
That was quite the intro.
Well, they deserve quite the intro. I think they were our very first advertiser, and they're still here. It's probably because we're so enthusiastic about their product. You've heard us talk about the amazing shave we get from our Dollar Shave Club razor, and especially when we use it with our Dr. Carver shave butter. Well, now we're here to tell you that we're never giving up our membership. In fact, we're adding to it with even more Dollar Shave Club products in our daily routine.
Dollar Shave Club makes products for your hair, face, skin, shower. It's everything you need. They have us looking and feeling amazing.
We do, don't we, Mike?
I feel amazing.
And look amazing.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You do as well. You look refreshed.
Why, thank you. I think that was my 3-day trip, though. And it's all their own original stuff. They only use the finest premium ingredients, and they deliver it to you just like they do their razors.
That means no more annoying trips to the store, cruising up and down the aisles, looking at the shelf of, what the hell is that, and what do I do with it?
That's right. It's very clear. It has step-by-step instructions, everything you get from Dollar Shave Club. You don't have to ask that.
It's very simple. I like it.
We use Dollar Shave Club for almost everything. Razors, body cleanser, hair gel.
Hair gel. Yes, hair gel.
And yes, even butt wipes. Dollar Shave Club has you covered head to toe, front and back.
And all parts in between. And right now, it's a great time to give Dollar Shave Club a try. You can get your first month of their best razor, along with travel-size versions of shave butter, body cleanser, and yes, even butt wipes for just $5.
$5. After that, replacement cartridges ship for just a few bucks a month. It's the Dollar Shave Club starter set. Get yours for just $5 exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court.
Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you. And now, Mike, to complete the trifecta, we have back with us Sleep Number Mattresses. Their theme this month is honoring our military. We all know sleep is important, but consider someone you know who is in the military or a veteran. Imagine how much a good night's sleep means to them.
This month, Sleep Number is honoring our nation's heroes with savings reserved just for them.
The Sleep Number bed lets you choose your ideal comfort and support on each side. It's the perfect bed for couples.
Their newest beds are so smart, they actually sense your every move and automatically adjust, so you can stay sleeping comfortably throughout the night.
They even have an adjustment for snoring. I'll bet your bed doesn't do that.
It doesn't, and I actually snore.
Well, I had to get a mask, so I don't.
Sleep Number beds cost about the same as traditional mattresses, last twice as long, and 91% of the owners recommend them.
Come in for exclusive savings just for military and veterans. And right now, it's the semi-annual sale where you'll find clearance savings of $600 on a Sleep Number P6 mattress with Sleep IQ technology.
You'll only find Sleep Number at any of the 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Visit sleepnumber.com to find the store nearest you.
And be sure to tell them that Court Appointed sent you. If only they would add a feature that it gets up and pees for you, it would be perfect for me.
You need like a Mr. Thirsty?
I guess, or a built-in catheter.
So what's the next case we have up?
The next case is Zippo Manufacturing Company v. Zippo.com.
Zippo v. Zippo.
That's right. Not to be confused with Zippo and Harpo and Marco.
Marco's the Marshall mascot.
That's true.
Just throwing it out there.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Now, this is why this was important. The web is worldwide, thus the World Wide Web, right?
W.
That's right. So, which courts get to decide if a certain website has violated the law? This case paved the way towards establishing standards in that regard under the legal concept of personal jurisdiction.
Now, we just talked about personal jurisdiction, didn't we?
We did. We talked about personal jurisdiction.
It was just last week.
Yes, that's true. Right after the robots.
That's right. So this is a tie-in.
Yeah, this works right in with it. Now, Zippo Manufacturing, that well-known Pennsylvania lighter company, sued Zippo.com, a California web company that provided about 140,000 users with access to Usenet news groups. The court battle involved perceived trademark violations. The lighter company wanted the web company to stop using the name Zippo. So, the main point in the case was the lighter company operated exclusively in Pennsylvania, while the internet company only conducted about 2% of its business in Pennsylvania, where it had registered about 3,000 users. Now, the main thing that they decided in here was the distinction to be made was between a passive website and an interactive one. Because the internet company conducted an interactive business via forums with the 3,000 or so Pennsylvania users, that was enough to establish personal jurisdiction and force the internet company to relinquish the Zippo name in Pennsylvania. So Zippo.com, it ended up, they went out of business before the case was actually even settled, but that was for other reasons.
Yeah. So what this did is it established what's known as the Zippo test. And that is basically where the courts consider whether or not a site was passive, interactive, or commercial, like you said. And that's a way to decide whether or not it should be held liable under a state's laws. Now, this was a 1997 case. So again, it's in that same wheelhouse we were just talking about. And it's evolved a little bit since then. But this was the basic first test that really kind of brought that up and brought that whole World Wide Web jurisdiction issue to the forefront. Now, like I said, in my civil procedure class, which I took in law school, we didn't talk about the Zippo test. It was too new. You know, we talked about International Shoe, Pennoyer v. Neff, like the two cases that we talked about with personal jurisdiction. In the International Shoe case, basically what they looked at was were the minimum contacts sufficient for jurisdiction to be proper. And that's essentially kind of what they did here is they took that International Shoe test and then applied it with the internet and kind of looked at, you know, did Zippo.com have minimum contacts with that state? And did they really have reason to, I guess, could they have sued in that state and been sued in that state? Did they have contacts with it? And they said with 3,000 users, yeah, they have contacts with this state.
Well, probably the other thing that helped too is that it made them active users because they actually had to pay to get that service. Now, if they were just looking at this and it was a website and they didn't charge to be a user on that, probably they would have been considered passive and may not have had a stance in.
Right. And that just goes more to like the contacts, I think, with the state, because by being that, not being passive, by being active, it increases the amount of contact with that forum state. So I think it is very similar to the existing law that was already out there with regard to personal jurisdiction, but it just kind of put a new spin on it.
And see, I didn't even know what that was before last week.
Yeah, so now you know what personal jurisdiction is.
Yeah, I didn't even know. I was stumbling back into that. It's funny how these cases keep circling back around to things that we've covered.
I know. It's almost like we're picking these ideas not at random.
Well, they're all random to me. I don't know what we're going to do from day to day. I walked in here today and didn't know exactly what we were doing.
It's like, I like to keep you in the dark, Tommy.
I lead my life that way.
It adds for a more true court-appointed experience if you're in the dark before I come in here.
Well, you're lucky because I stay that way.
What's the next case?
The next case, Pro-CD v. Zeidenberg. This was a 1996 case. The reason that this one's important, oh, I've heard a lot of people discuss this on our site before. They've even said that we think they should have a whole episode on this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we could.
If you click to agree, it's official. You agreed. This case confirms it. This is the one that all those big, long things, those, what do they call those? The things that you got to click on.
The shrink wrap contract?
Yeah, all those things that you got to click on to go load the software or do whatever it is mm-hmm. that you agree to. This is the one that started that. What this case is about is a grad student, Matthew Zeidenberg, purchased a CD-ROM telephone directory, Select Phone. He loaded it onto his hard drive and clicked through a series of warnings that the directory was licensed by ProCD and that users were not allowed to share the CD-ROM's contents with any commercial pursuit. Zeidenberg ignored the warnings and posted the directory to a website offering users access to the directory for a fee slightly lower than what ProCD charged. Telephone directories are not protected by a copyright. So, and the case to back that up was Feist v. Rural. Rural. That's a hard word to say, rural.
Rural.
And that was Zeidenberg's argument. You can't protect the copyright of something that can't be copyrighted. But the United States Appeals Court decided that the series of warnings that Zeidenberg clicked through were enforceable as a contract, meaning that Zeidenberg was in violation of a legal agreement.
So, basically, this case has been criticized a lot because it has in there these shrink wrap contracts, and they're basically boilerplate contracts. And when I say boilerplate, I mean something that has like all the standard terms in there that you really can't negotiate. It's just take it or leave it kind of contracts. And essentially what this case stands for is the fact that those things hold up, that, you know, if you click on it, you agree to it. Now, I think you can use some common sense when looking at these cases. Now, somebody taking this information and which he agrees not to share it for commercial purposes and then basically saying, no, I'm going to buy your product and then put it out there and undercut you and sell it for cheaper. I think under some sort of equitable argument, that's just not fair. You shouldn't be able to do what Zeidenberg did there.
Well, no, that'd be the same thing as with music.
Yeah.
If you copied somebody's album and then listed it on the internet and sold downloads of it for less than what they sold the CD for or something.
Yeah. Well, but that's already copyrighted. So that's already copyright information.
Well, that's true. That's copyrighted.
What he was saying is basically he was taking stuff that can't be copyrighted and trying to sell it.
Yeah.
But still, they have compiled it themselves and gone through the work of putting it together and had an agreement, at least, where it says you agreed not to do that. So, I mean, I think it's reasonable for him to not be allowed to do that.
Could he have posted it and just made it available to everybody for free?
Well, I mean, depending on what that contract said, maybe. You know, if he wanted to do it out of the kindness of his heart. So, I mean, there are people that do things like that with information that's out there. Like, mm-hmm. you'll find books and whatnot that have been released out there that people, I don't know if they scanned them or typed them or whatever, but they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, I think, you know, again, using the common sense thing, if you throw things in these boilerplate contracts, like you're agreeing to some sort of crazy thing that has nothing to do with what you're actually purchasing or doing, you know, there's no way a court's going to hold that up. And the thing that always comes to mind is there's a South Park episode where basically they click on the Apple terms and conditions agreement. And basically they agree to become part of a human scent iPad.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that, but I think you brought that up before.
Yeah. And so, I mean, they basically agree to become an experiment, to become a centipede.
Mm-hmm.
So they,
I get that.
Yeah.
Heads in the butts and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. No need to go into that. It's a good episode. You should check it out.
Yeah, right. Some more of that content they can't keep you from watching.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad the internet's out there. But anyway, no, I mean, if you have things like that in these agreements, obviously that is not anywhere related to an update for your iPhone. So,
you know, they can't slip in there that they get your firstborn or anything like that.
No, right? No, they can't do that because, I mean, that's just, well, number one, I'm sure there's some other law against that, but anyway.
Some other law against bartering babies on the internet.
Yeah, I don't know if it's illegal, but I know it when I see it. That can't be legal.
Yeah, that violates the rational decency test.
Exactly. I don't know what that is, but it sounds reasonable to me.
I just made it up.
So yeah, but that's kind of an interesting case, and I understand why people would be kind of critical of it, because when taken to an extreme, it's silly. But when taken in kind of the context of it's basically just protecting the thing that it's actually allowing you to use, I think it makes sense.
So I guess what we're saying is there isn't any sense in having an episode about that, because if you click through and click you agree. So you better read it.
Yeah.
Because it's an enforceable contract.
Yeah, especially if you downloaded any of our episodes, then you've agreed to a whole lot of things that is in the fine print. We're not going to get into that, but don't worry about it. You'll find out later.
When you get your bill.
Thanks. All right, enough about that.
See you from the Bahamas.
Enough about that. Who do we have next? What's the next case?
The next case. Religious Technology Center v. Netcom. Why is this case important? Well, this case established that linking to another site doesn't equal stealing content from that site. Now, this came about through the Church of Scientology. Dennis Ehrlich posted links to unpublished L. Ron Hubbard manuscripts on the Usenet news group at Religion Scientology, hosted by Netcom server.
Let me just clear that up. That's alt.religion.scientology would be the proper terminology for that.
I see. What did I say? Usenet news group, alt.religion Scientology. Oh, I see. I didn't recognize that.
Yeah, it's got the dots in there, so it's important.
My glasses don't pick up too well in this lighting. Thank you for fixing that for me, because otherwise that would have been bad.
Maybe.
People wouldn't be able to find it in case they wanted to look at it. It didn't even sound like a website.
I don't know if Usenet groups are even around anymore.
Well, that may be, but they might have wanted to research it historically.
There you go.
Anyway, it was hosted by Netcom server. Scientology held copyrights for the not exactly dead church leaders' unpublished manuscripts. The Church of Scientology sued Netcom for hosting the files, insinuating that it should have known that the files were copyrighted and that it had harmed the Church of Scientology for allowing the files to be posted. The U.S. District Court in Northern California decided in Netcom's favor, noting that Netcom had no reason to expect that Ehrlich, a random user, was publishing copyrighted material, and that ruling against Netcom would seriously infringe upon First Amendment rights in the future. From the decision, Netcom plays a vital role in the speech of their users, requiring them to pre-screen postings for possible infringement that would chill their user speech.
Yeah, it's kind of an important case if you think about it, because really you have all this information, and the whole theory of the internet is that it's a web and it's linked, like a spider web. So by linking things back and forth, you're not necessarily stealing content. You're essentially linking it to other places, which actually makes it more visible and easier to find.
Yeah, it's already out there. You're just helping people find it.
Yeah, so this is kind of an underpinning of the entire theory of what the internet's about, I think. So, and the whole thing too is that, then we're kind of going back to that previous case we talked about too, the Zoran v. AOL, that if you're making these different places where this information is hosted or gathered, then essentially what you're doing is you're expecting that company or that server group to essentially police everything that is posted on there to make sure that content is acceptable. So, it's kind of like having an admin of a group message board to make sure that they have to police everything that's posted and remove whatever it is that particular person doesn't like. It's kind of a slippery slope.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and that case was a 1995 case. That's actually one of the earlier ones. Probably one of the first cases we talked about.
That was probably pre-Tom Cruise, huh?
Pre-Tom Cruise, yeah. So, I don't know if it was pre-Tom Cruise. It was before he became popular as a Scientologist. So, on a lot of these cases...
Well, that's what I meant.
They're very litigious, Scientologists. So, they have played quite a role in jurisprudence in our country.
In jurisprudence?
That's right.
That's a neat word, jurisprudence.
It is. You have to have jurisprudence to make sure you're regular.
That's right. The Scientologists, they like you to follow their stuff, but they don't like you to look at their stuff if they're not looking at you looking at it.
That's a good point.
So that's why they didn't want people linking up and seeing their stuff without them regulating what you're seeing.
No. We don't want you to see that. We want you to see this.
Yeah. You look at this. This is more along the lines of what we're interested in you seeing.
Look at my e-meter. So we have one more case, and what's this case?
This case is Perfect 10 Incorporated v. Amazon.com.
And this was a 2007 case. This is like the newest case we have on our list.
This is the most current case of any of them. Now, this is why it's important. Have you ever heard of Google Image Search?
I have.
Of course you have. This case is why it and other similar services are allowed to exist. What this case is about. A Perfect 10 was a magazine and subscription website in the vein of Hustler. Airbrushed nudie pics of open-mouth young women, basically with less meddlesome politics to get in the way of body parts on display. Third-party websites took images from Perfect 10's subscription site and posted them, violating the subscription site's copyright. While those third-party sites were clearly in the wrong, Perfect 10's lawyers also argued that search indexes used by Google and Amazon, which used some of the stolen third-party images, were also in violation. The argument crawled slowly through the court system, but eventually it made it to that famous court that seems to make a lot of decisions, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. There it was determined that the potential harm from linking to Perfect 10's market remains hypothetical, and that the search indexes were worth protecting because they provided access to pictorial information on the internet. And because search engine technology provides an astoundingly valuable public benefit, which should not be jeopardized just because it might be used in a way that could affect anybody's sales.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important case because essentially the internet is so big that if you do not have adequate search engines with the appropriate algorithms to be able to locate what you're looking for, you will never find anything. So it's very important that you don't kind of hinder the ability to search the internet because that would shut it down.
Well, it would be hard for you to follow all the different possibilities that you would need to put in to say, when you're looking for these images, don't find these kind and don't find this kind. And you can't include this. It'd be too hard to try to enumerate because it's always changing.
It is. And there, when legal research, when you learn that in law school and you're learning how to search different terms when you're looking for cases on Westlaw or Lexis or Find Law or any of the different websites where you search for case law, they explain to you quite a bit about how to use these search terms to find what it is you're looking for. Because there's certain characters you can put in, like a W/10, which would basically mean within 10 words of something. So you can, and you can use these kinds of searches too, I think, with Google and all those kinds of things too. So you can be very specific with what you're searching for. So It's very important to not limit the power of these search engines, because by doing that, you're essentially, again, chilling free speech, sort of, by doing that.
Well, the other argument I could make for that, too, is that by having your images included in these Google searches, somebody comes across the images and likes them, well, maybe they'll go to your site and then purchase whatever it is you're peddling.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily, even though, yes, they're giving away some of your images, it could potentially bring customers to you, so you can't prove absolute harm from it.
If they're linked appropriately. Now, for example, if say like I'm a member of Perfect 10's subscription website and I find a picture that I like and I say, you know what, I'm going to host that on my website. And so I copy it, I right click it and copy it, and then I paste it on my webpage, and then I charge $1 to come look at it. Whenever people see that link, it's coming to my site, not to theirs. So, I mean, it could, in theory, steal from them.
Well, but probably if it's coming up on yours, it's coming up from theirs, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it's searching for the same type criteria.
But you know who is wrong? Who is the person who perpetrated that wrong? The person who stole the picture.
And not, put it up.
Not
and,
the phone book.
Right, that stole the copyrighted one.
Not the phone book. Yeah, because that's really what, I mean, it is kind of like a sophisticated phone book. It's how you find stuff.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think they were trying to reach with that, and it is definitely a reach.
Well, you're always looking for the deep pockets, aren't you? And AOL probably had deeper pockets than any of the other people they were dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, some sweaty dude on his computer that copied all these pictures down and pasted them up. I mean, he's probably
selling you music.
Yeah, he's probably not the richest of rich.
Yeah, that's right.
So one interesting thing I thought about when I was reading about this case is, do you know what XBMC is, or now it's called Kodi? Have you ever heard of that?
No, I have not.
Well, what it is basically kind of like a directory that allows you to find different streaming videos from around the world. Mm-hmm. And these streaming videos are, could be of like movies that are still in theaters. They're, you know, people with their, with cameras that went to theaters and actually hand canned them.
Bootlegs.
Yeah. Bootlegs. All kinds of TV shows and stuff that is super, mm-hmm. super copyright and protected. No question about it.
All right.
Now, the websites that host these videos are clearly in the wrong.
Exactly.
But they're overseas. They're hard to shut down. So essentially what this XBMC or Kodi does is it kind of almost crawls the web and finds them and compiles all these different videos that you can stream into one place. So it's kind of one of those interesting things, like, yeah, as far as technology goes, is it illegal?
Sounds like it.
Well, it's illegal to host them for sure, but is it illegal to access that and find these different websites and watch videos on the internet?
Well, it seems like it would be illegal to put them on a site, but not to link to the site where they exist.
That's right. Now, do you think it'd be illegal for like me to watch these if I see them somewhere?
No. I would say if you find them on the web that they're fair game.
I would think so, too.
I mean, at worst case scenarios, the site that's hosting them might be doing something illegal, but you, by watching them, I don't think you are.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. And I think it kind of goes with what the internet is all about, too. It's, if you really want to protect your information, then go after the person who's actually doing the wrong, not somebody who's just kind of benefiting from it.
You know, what's probably interesting, too, is we're looking at a lot of these cases, 96, 97, so they were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
20 years from now, there's probably cases that are going on right now that are going to further shape things that we don't know about that are happening, that we would look back and say, wow, I didn't know that was going on. We were talking about that. Look at these ones that were going on right now.
My personal servant robot, Sophia, accidentally went to the Perfect 10 website and downloaded some things there and posted it back up to my whatever. And so they're going to sue my robot. I don't know.
Well, that's possible. And who's responsible? That robot's a citizen. You're going to have to hold it responsible.
That's right. Not my problem. So that's Sophia's fault.
You must terminate.
No, it's First Law of Robotics.
I'll be back.
Well, that's going to do it, and that's going to bring us to...
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we talk about different terms and kind of go back over them and really hammer those down.
With our tool. Our internet tool.
Our rock.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer...
In the morning. Okay.
I'd hammer in the evening. All over this land, basically.
So, the first term that we're going to bring up is an old friend. Personal jurisdiction.
Personal jurisdiction, well, that has to do with where you got to go to court at. Whether you actually exist in a state and have relevance there for them to make you come and answer a complaint or a suit or whatever.
That's exactly right. Now, how is it different than subject matter jurisdiction?
Subject matter jurisdiction, it has to do with stuff that we didn't want to talk about last time.
That's true.
That you kept steering me away from.
But subject matter jurisdiction is whether or not the court has the ability to hear that kind of case in general. Like if it's if the case in controversy is for more money.
Like the dollar amounts that you gave, the lower courts could only hear up to $5,000, the next one from $5,000 to $15,000, and
right.
The next court over $15,000.
Right. So it has to do with that. So yeah, exactly. The next term, click wrap or shrink wrap.
That's those boilerplate things that you click through on agreement terms and things like that.
And what do we mean when we say boilerplate?
Well, they're all set up as a catch-all, and they cover everything that there is, and it's just basically to protect them from everything.
Yeah, and the other thing about boilerplate contracts, too, and this is important, is that they are generally not negotiable. They
take it or leave it
contract. It's the thing that just comes, and it's like, here, sign this.
And so, you say, okay, I want to play this video game.
Or you say, one time I went to play paintball, and they gave me a boilerplate release, and I crossed off a couple things and handed it back to them with a smirk on my face, and the person didn't even realize it, and I was like, ha-ha!
Gotcha!
Today, the man doesn't win.
That's like when I went in to get my LASIKs done on my eyes, I had to read all this literature that told me all the myriad of things that could go wrong with this surgery, and then at the end it says, and we're not responsible for any of it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? What do you mean? That my eyesight, I could have this done, my eyesight could be worse. Not only that, I could be blind, and it's okay? that's all right, and I'm releasing you? Well, all right. So I signed it and got the LASIK done.
Yeah, you know, maybe I go blind. I've had a good run. That always makes me think of, too, and I don't know that this is actually a law. I just always heard this maybe one of those urban legends. But you know how there's different drugs that are advertised on TV?
Mm-hmm.
And they go through the rundown of like the possible side effects.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I always heard the reason they have to tell you all the possible side effects is if they tell you what the possible benefits are, they have to tell you what the side effects are. Hmm. So, and when I've watched TV, I heard this a while ago. And when I watch TV, I've noticed that if the ad is just, you know, two guys out there throwing a baseball and then they're sitting on a swing and they're just talking about really random stuff and how it can help your life, but they don't tell you what it does.
How's your erectile dysfunction?
Well, no,
it's fine. How's yours?
They don't tell you what it's for. They don't tell you what it does. It's just like, it says, ask your doctor if it can help you. They never tell you the bad side of it.
Right.
But if they do say, Steve, I tell you what, I sure have some erectile dysfunction going on right now. They're like, well, you should take blah, blah, blah pill because it'll
help things out
help
in that
things
region.
Out down there.
Let's not get too specific.
Yeah. But then if the commercial says that, then they go on, by the way, X pill may cause diarrhea, bleeding from the mouth, bleeding from the ear, bleeding from the nose, bleeding from the eyes, bleeding from the fingers.
I think I'd rather be droopy. Never mind.
Yeah, exactly. So, I always heard that. I don't know if that's true or not. But if I've watched TV and, you know, I see these commercials and it seemed to be pretty true because if they tell you what it does, tell you what it could possibly do, too.
I've just always wanted a bathtub like that.
Where you could sit outside in a bluff.
Yeah.
Take a bath.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A bluff on the buff.
Now, so the final question is, name either Supreme Court test that I have mentioned. There's two.
Strict scrutiny.
That's right.
And the one for the public welfare or something like that.
Rational basis.
Okay.
Which one's harder?
Strict scrutiny.
That's right. That's the one that basically if it gets assigned a strict scrutiny test, it's probably not going to pass. So.
All right. Well, the word strict is kind of a giveaway as which one's harder.
Yeah. So we kind of bounced around about some different legal theories, but they're all in the vein of internet technology. And it kind of goes back on some of our previous episodes, too, where we've talked about these different legal theories.
Just not pertaining to the internet.
Yeah. So if you think about it, the legal theories we have in place, as technology increased, we just had to kind of apply these existing laws into technology and let it kind of evolve.
And now you know why some of the things are what they are on the internet. Why some of the things exist and why you have to do things certain ways. And, you know, I know we've always had a lot of questions about those agreements, whether they're enforceable or not. And apparently they are.
To a certain degree, I think.
As long as you don't have to become a human centipede.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
No.
Especially if you're in the middle.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Strong. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.